This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, not busy with duties, and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm, and wise and skillful, not proud and demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove, wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be happy, whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be happy. Let none deceive another, or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another, even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings, radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, upwards and unbounded, free from hatred and ill will, whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding, by not holding to false views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.
Okay. Excellent. So, the questions. Oh, but you're very kind, not so many today. It's only one. Dear Ajahn, how we remove thoughts that come to our mind when we meditate? Shall we both go back quickly to anapana or metta meditation? Oh, the thoughts which come into, there's actually a sutra on that, removal of distracting thoughts. And the best way is actually to what they call substitution, number one, in other words, think of something else. In other words, think of peace, of silence, of happiness. How many years have you been thinking? How many hours have you wasted thinking? And have your thoughts got you anywhere? Honestly. Except headaches, worry. So, and those of you who have questions you have to answer, problems you have to solve, just decisions you have to make, you don't need to think so much. Who was it? This is one example amongst many. There was a social worker, and she had this really hard job of having to choose the final decision whether somebody should have their kids removed from them. Because they may have been drug addicts, alcoholics, just a mother who was really a danger to her child. It's not an easy choice to make. Really tough. And you only do that if it's really extreme. So she had to make those decisions. So high stress job. If you left the kid there, the kid might be just abused or not fed or even killed. But you always respect, you know, the bond between a mother and a child. So it's a difficult thing to do. But anyway, so she came to my retreat, and late at night, because just to tie up all the loose ends. You can't tie up all the loose ends. There's always unfinished business. But as she came on the retreat, she was really smart enough. She rested for the first few days, started meditating, and then she told me about 6 or 7 days into the retreat, she was meditating, really peaceful. She forgot all about her work. And then all these solutions came up to some of the most difficult problems. They just came up out of nowhere. And so she wrote them all down and then carried on meditating. She told me in interview time that she's going to implement those decisions once she goes back to work. But the point was, she never tried to think about solutions. She was quiet. Put them all aside, and the solutions came up by themselves. And not only solutions to difficult problems, answers to very difficult questions. That's what insight is all about. We think too much, and we block the solutions coming up. So, there was a fellow called Brian Josephson, who was meditating. It was TM meditation, but still meditation. And he just managed to figure out just this way, they called it quantum tunneling. And he sort of wrote it all out. He got the insight while he was meditating, well, towards the end of the meditation. And he wrote it all down, and he's now got a Nobel Prize for that. It's the Josephson Junction, it's quantum tunneling, which allows computers to work at, you know, close to absolute zero. So it's the essence of supercomputing. And he got that because he was meditating. So many great problems are solved, not through thinking. We use our brains very inefficiently. So instead we put all the information in and then see what comes out. But we don't keep thinking about it and worrying about it. Put it in, relax, let go, and then answers come. The same with, we've mentioned this before, choices. Oh, you have a choice of what to do once you leave here. And then, oh no, should I go left, should I go right? And we spend so much time thinking about those choices we make in life. Thinking this way, or that way, or that way, or this way. And it just drives us crazy. So what we do, we get all the information, put it in our brain, and leave it alone and meditate and have a wonderful time. And then when it's time to make the choice, It's usually quite obvious. Once you've been still and allowed the brain to do its job, where you're not interfering with all this thinking and worrying, and then you just make the choice. And it doesn't matter what choice you make. Really? Because what really matters is how much energy you've got left once you've made the choice to make it work. People spend so much thought energy in deciding what to do, to go left or go right, and they've got no, once they made that choice, they've got no energy left. But imagine, save all that energy, you go left, and you make it work. You've got all this oomph left. You haven't wasted your energy. So that's actually just how we work. I've got many decisions to make, and some of them you just forget all about them. And then it becomes quite obvious later on. And then you put your energy in and make it work. Should we ordain bhikkhunis or not? Yeah, some people say we should, some people say we didn't. So I just forgot about it. And then decided, yeah, why not? And once we did it, everything we've got, make it work. That's how it works in life. So that's why we don't worry so much. So we use our brains inefficiently. But if thoughts do come up when you're meditating, they're distracting you. Number one, if you don't want to sort of think of something else, like beautiful visualizations of the Buddha meditating under a Bodhi tree, that's a wonderful substitution. Or substitute it by feelings in your body, instead of thoughts. Or if you really get obstructed by thoughts, go outside and see the stars and the moon in the sky. Go and feel the wind in your face. Go and have a cup of tea and taste the tea. So when we're saying substitution, it's not substituting with something worse. It's actually substituting with something which gives rise to peace, which is more important to you, more attractive. And then the thoughts disappear. If they still don't disappear, then just do that, putting some space between you and the thoughts, so you can see them from a distance. Oh, you know, well, what are these thoughts? So what? That was the experience I had when, on an aircraft years ago, and just the screen came down, and there was a movie. And the screen was right in front of me, I couldn't miss it. I didn't have any headphones, so I just watched without any music or dialogue. And it was the movie, I remember it to this day, Armageddon. The end of the world. But you didn't actually have to know what the plot was. It's very easy to work out. Number one, please excuse me, Americans had to save the world. And they had to have a fight before they saved the world. And they could only save the world at the very last moment, with seconds to spare. Why does it always happen? With seconds to spare. Why can't they save it very early on so they can just relax? Because there's no movie there, no excitement, is there? So, but anyway, I was laughing my head off because you can say exactly what's going on. But the part which I will never forget was when one of their spacecraft, it was some asteroid or meteor or some big rock, was going to hurtle into the earth, going to hit it and devastate the whole of life. And so, one of the spacecraft, they crash landed on this comet or whatever, asteroid, and they crash landed on it. And you could see, I don't know how they could get the photographs, because there was no other movie apparatus on this planet. But anyway, they could actually see it from a distance as it was landed on it. And as it crash landed on the planet, it whacked into the planet really hard, and sparks and explosions and fires going everywhere, bang, bang, as it rolled over, more explosions, more sparks, more sort of electrical bangs, and then it fell over a cliff, went right down the bottom, more bangs, crashes, and stuff like that. Even 1 second of that sort of impact would have killed, it would have even killed sort of Superman or Iron Man or Batman or I don't know what. Anyway, it would certainly kill any human being. There was really explosions and stuff. But then eventually it came to a halt. I had about 5 minutes of pyrotechnics and explosions and other special effects. And then it went quiet. And a hand came up from the bottom of the screen and it held up to something. And he pulled himself up. It was a hero. And his, what really, not only what did he survive, he had no scars on him. His hair was perfectly coiffed. And not even any beads of sweat on him. He survived, he made it. And I looked at the person sitting next to me and, oh, he was so relieved. And I was, I really got sucked into that movie. I was laughing my head off. The most ridiculous thing I'd ever seen. No one could ever survive that crash. They'd be strawberry jam. They'd be messed up. They'd be mashed into a pulp. This fellow, he wasn't even not a bead of sweat or no soot on his face and his hair. I don't know how he managed to do that. Maybe just after it crashed, he had time just to brush his hair before he came up to the camera. So anyway, sort of, when you don't have the commentary on, it's just so ridiculous. Next time you see a movie, try not to put the sound on. Just watch the action. And then there's no, whenever there's the romance, you see the, or whatever it is, when it goes very fast when there's an action. So there's music score, that actually just winds you up. We don't have the music score. For the funerals. But when you don't have the music score, it doesn't play on your emotions and it's just a stupid thing. So that's the same with your thoughts. So you just stand back and you find that just they are empty. Nothing to them. Just thoughts. Distractions. Things which will never happen. But the point is, as somebody once said, if it's a fantasy, in the fantasy, you're always the winner and the hero. You always manage to save the world. Or you always manage to score the winning goal for the cup final. You always manage to get the most perfect girl or boy. You manage to win the lottery in your dreams. In real life, ha ha ha, fat chance. So that's why people like to fantasize and think, because it gives them a sense of winning. But real life isn't like that. So that's one of the reasons why we like to think we can make our fantasy world, where we're always a winner. But after a while, you think, that's nothing. You might win in your fantasies, but you have to come out and go to work afterwards. So after a while, we just lose all the attraction to such thoughts. You see, they're suffering. They're just not really worth anything. And peace, stillness is wonderful. So the more you experience some peace and stillness, the more you love peace and stillness. And after a while, you're not into the thoughts anymore. You use your thoughts for what they're really supposed to be there for. Not to fantasize and dream and overthink, but just to think the right amount, which is not that much. So you put some spaces between your thoughts as well. That's the other way of overcoming thoughts. Now, you hear the spaces between my words. It's wonderful. So this is one of the ways. And there's a few Indonesians here. They've got this wonderful greeting as Buddhists. They say Namo Buddhaya to one another. So that's another way you can overcome the thoughts. You recite to yourself, Namo Buddhaya. Namo Buddhaya. Namo. It sort of blocks out the thoughts. But then you start to slow it down. Na mo buddhaya. Na mo. And slowly you extend the spaces not more put die. Yeah. And if thoughts come in, you close the spaces up a bit. You can use anything like that, Om Mani Padme Hum, or Namo Tassa, whatever. Just, you know, a short little mantra you say to yourself over and over again. But the trouble with mantras, people say it to themselves over and over and over and over again, and they never forget to put the spaces between the syllables to give silence and entry into the mind. Na. Mo. And the silence soon takes over. You don't need the other. Anyway, you mentioned briefly that internet Wi-Fi causes problems and wastes the energy of our mind. Can you please elaborate on this? Yeah, it is because the internet, I've already seen, you've already found out where you can get internet connections. You can't get it down here, but if you walk up the hill, that's where you get it. See people up the hill with their stuff. But anyway, sometimes you think it's really important. Is it? Imagine you don't answer your emails for 9 days. Will the world stop? It doesn't. So, if you come on these retreats and you really want to have a very peaceful time, you know, just you can give the phone number to Bianca. Any emergencies, please call. Otherwise, be quiet. And any of you actually called your home just to see everything okay? See everything's okay. Just the fear. Isn't it really the fear? And actually they call, what is it called? The FOMO. Fear of missing out. Are you afraid of missing out? I would love to miss out. So I didn't have to get worried about and concerned about anything. Missing out of what? The other people are missing out. They're missing out of silence and freedom. Do you remember when we didn't have internet? We couldn't, you had need to call somebody, you have to phone them. Or even better, go and see them and knock on their door. Hi, how are you? Is life better with modern technology? I remember these supporters over in Thailand. That, no, Ajahn Chah used to stay with them when he was in Thailand. They had a nice little hut in the back of their garden, quiet, secluded. And so whenever I go to Thailand, I usually go and stay there these days. And they told me that they, first of all, they lived in Sathon, no, a long way away. Not really a long way away, but they said it took them about 4 hours in an ox cart the first time to go from their old house in Sathon to their new house in the bottom of Sukhumvit, Pakhonon. And they say, that was in about 30, 40 years before. They have to go in an ox cart, took 4 hours. And then they said, these days, it still takes 4 hours in a traffic jam. So much for progress. So sometimes we wonder, just progress. Waste the energy of our mind. Can you please add that? I'm asking this because I experience that when at home I sleep with my phone on airplane mode, I tend to sleep more restfully. Yeah, great. It's nothing to do with electromagnetic radiation. It's everything to do with just concern and just attachment. And you can't let things go, so you keep worrying. So you don't need to worry. Think things are going to go wrong anyway. That's life. So, when you know they're going to go wrong, you know you don't need to go and find out if they're going to go wrong. You know they're going to go wrong. I can predict the future. It's going to go wrong. But at least you can have a wonderful, peaceful time before it goes wrong. Isn't that wonderful? You just live in this moment. Just, I think the Dalai Lama said this, to quote, you know, to give credit to the right people. He said, if you can achieve something by worrying about it, then fair enough, worry about it. If you can make a difference. If you can't make a difference, what's the point? You're just disturbing yourself. So I quite like that. That's if there's something to do, then do it. There's nothing to do. Do nothing. That's the best. Most thoughts are negative anyway. Anyway, asking this with utmost respect. How do monks and nuns manage to live without deodorant, etc.? Because our nose gets stuffed so we can't smell ourselves. But we do usually shower every day. And well, I have to shower twice when it's hot outside just to keep from smelling funky and gross. How do you know you smell funky and gross? How many times a day do kangaroos have to shower? Do they wear deodorant? Sometimes I wonder, but whenever it rains, I say, oh great, it's raining today, so the kangaroos can have a shower. Sometimes just natural smells of people. But is it really disgusting? So anyway, how do monks and nuns manage to live without deodorant? We do shower and do wash our robes. We sit outside just to keep from smelling funky and gross because we learn to be peaceful. So when you learn to not to worry, your metabolism goes down. You don't sweat. Well, we always say that when it's hot, you learn how to keep a cool head. And when it's cold, you learn how to keep a warm heart. So then you balance. Your test put is climate control. Anyway, an obviously unawakened one. Very good. So that's how we work. Hi Ajahn, what makes most people lose steam in their practice? How lose steam in their practice? I think a lot of time is because they see no peace and happiness, and they other things take precedence. This is a good answer, because when I was a layperson, I was very diligent meditating, and it took about 1 or 2 years after I started, and I can't remember exactly where this is, but I know it was like I was having a cup of coffee in some restaurant somewhere, and I was talking with this French guy, and talking about meditation, and he was a meditator too, and so I said, yeah, I was really into meditation for the first year. The second year it started to fall off a bit. He said, yes, because you're not asking yourself about the difference it makes to you. And he recommended something which, if ever I saw him, I said, thank you, you changed my life. So at the end of the meditation, every meditation, ask yourself at the very end, does this feel different than when you started? It may not be the jhanas, it may not be nimittas, it may not be even delightful breath. But when I start to do that, at the end of every meditation, just do like a debriefing. What happened and why? Do you feel better? You know, every meditation, it may not have been a deep meditation, but I certainly felt better than when I started. I was actually noticing feedback. It was actually making me more peaceful. Not as peaceful as I wanted to be. More happy. Not as happy as I thought I deserved to be. More relaxed, but not as relaxed as sometimes I got. But it still was an improvement. When I started noticing that, it gave me motivation. I got feedback. Other people tell you for sure, yeah, you're a much better person. You've got to see that for yourself. Otherwise, you lose steam. You know, it's not working. And the other one, to keep the inspiration going in order to reach the highest, bliss, then you come on retreats. Because it's on the retreats you really start to get some energy up. You start to get things brewing and boiling and steaming and really exploding and nuclear explosions and supernovas and black holes colliding, and so huge energies, amazing bliss. But they're only happy on retreats usually. Anyway, the next question. Hello, Jeeves. This must be from a Cockney or someone trying to be a Cockney. Do you believe in negative entities or dark spirits? Yep. Because some years ago, I was in Hong Kong, I did a presentation with, you may know him, Professor Richard Gombrich. You know, he's from Oxford University, and I was advertised from Cambridge University. We're doing a presentation together, and I introduced myself, and I said, I'm very happy to be here, just having a nice conversation with Professor Gombrich from the Oxford Buddhist Center or Studies Center, and he's from the dark side, and I'm from the light side, because Cambridge are the dark blues. So no, Oxford are the dark blues, Cambridge are the light blues. He's from the dark side. Anyone from Oxford is from the dark side. It explains Margaret Thatcher and Tony Blair. They're all from the dark side. No. That's only, do you believe in negative entities or dark spirits we need to protect ourselves from, or that are attached to us via etheric cords that we need to cut to release their influence over us? No. So, none of entities are attached to you. So, you can sort of have them be close to you if you want them. And if you're a really good person, really kind and gentle and generous and beautiful and keep your precepts, you can only get beautiful entities. You attract like attracts like. So, the story behind that is that there was, I don't know if I told it, that lady who was dying, I'm sorry, not dying, let's go back a bit, before she died, that there was a Thai girl who came over to Perth. She was an amazing sort of woman. I don't know, maybe, you know, there's any oldies here, Ratinda Faust, you know. You may even know her, well, no, maybe you don't, too old. But anyway, she was here for a while, really great supporter. And then she invited her mother to come to Perth, you know, just on a family reunion, when you could do that really easily. So her mother was very old, you know, living by in Ratbury, I think. And then so she invited, and the daughter looked after her. But it came to the time when her mum started to get very sick, so they put her in King Edward Hospital for women. And there she would look after her mother so well, even sleeping by her bedside, as the filial piety and looking after your parents in Buddhism showed. But then one day she decided that her mother was getting really sick, and she wondered whether this was going to be her last illness. So she went up to this spirit doctor, this medium, well known in Perth, and paid her $20 Australian to find out whether her mother was going to survive this sickness or not. So the medium took the $20 and she went into a trance. Oh, before they went into a trance, she asked, what's your mother's name? What hospital? What ward? What room? So she could find her on the astral plane and check her out. So she went into a trance, this medium, and then 20 minutes later she came back. And the first thing she did was to give the $20 back to the daughter. Said, why? Couldn't you find my mum? Said, oh yeah, I found her all right. I found the hospital. I found the ward. I found the room. But I couldn't go inside the room. It was like this force field around your mother. And I just could not penetrate it. I tried and tried, but I couldn't get inside there to check out whether she was really sick or not. Who is your mum? I haven't seen her for a long time. And this girl, Ratana, she said, my mother is a Buddhist nun. She's been a Buddhist nun for about 40 years. At which point, the medium got very upset. Grabbed the $20 back. He said, wasted my time. People like me can't get close to people like that. You should have told me before. And that's a lovely little story. So, even dark spirits, bad spirits, if you keep your precepts and are kind, they can't get close. You've got a protective field around you. Bum, ba, bum. Anyway, that's a nice little story. Sometimes somebody, I think I was in England, and somebody, actually when I was giving a talk, and Venerable Chanda was there with her mum and dad, and somebody asked me if I believed in black magic. I said, yes, I do. I said, I know it. It is actually, I even had some in my bag, so I gave some black magic chocolates. The Venerable Chanda's mum, and she really loved those. Could you please make sure Wednesday morning talks get uploaded to YouTube? It has the image technique that I've demonstrated for meditation. Thank you. Well, I mean, make sure. I'm not a control freak. If it happens, it happens. If it doesn't happen, it's just unfortunate karma, that's all. So I just give the talks. Once it's out of my mouth, where it goes, that's not my problem. Yeah, I'm sure most of the stuff gets recorded and put on the, unless the dark energy deletes it. The other day you mentioned that we will gain insights after a jhana and can't trust our mind before them to contemplate Dharma. Recently I read a book about Buddhist cosmology, and it seems some beings in jhana realms, such as Mahabrahmas, still quite deluded. Why? Is it because we need to hear Buddhist teachings as well? Yeah, so jhanas aren't enough, but without jhanas you can't really see things as they truly are. So in other words, it's necessary but not sufficient. If you know your logic, necessary and sufficient conditions, so you have to have those jhanas, that stillness, that peace of mind, that power when the five hindrances are overcome for long periods of time. And you need a good teacher, they're called like the words of another enlightened being. The seed. Sometimes they call it the transmission. Now, sometimes I always thought the Mahayana and Theravada and Vajrayana was so different, but the idea of a transmission is something to that. To hear the words from someone, at least a stream winner, they really get into you. They have a power. You can read them in a book, but hearing them live, it has much more impact on you. So where does that leave Siddhartha Gautama, our Buddha? Did he get those teachings, that seed, the word of another, from anybody? Did he hear that Dhamma from enlightened beings? How did the Buddha become enlightened? Where did he get his seed of enlightenment from? And a lot of people say, no, he found it out for himself. But then that doesn't make any sense to me at all. Because some of these teachings are just so hard to see. And we reject them with fear that that can't be the case. But they're true. That's why you do need it from somebody who has experienced it for themselves. So, what about the Buddha? And actually go to the Gatikara Sutta, where the Buddha tells, in this not that long ago, in this eon, the Buddha was a monk under Kassapa the Buddha. And Gatikara came to congratulate the Buddha in the Samyutta Nikaya. You know, he said we were just lived in the same village as before. We were disciples of Kassapa. Gatikara became an Anagami, and his friend Jyotibana, he became a disciple of the Buddha, the previous one, and that's our Siddhartha Gautama, the Sakyamuni Buddha. So there's the Buddha actually saying, and you know Brahma Sahampati, the one who came down and invited him to teach, he was another alumni of Kassapa, the Buddha. And he also, you know, knew the Buddha from that previous time. Those are all in the suttas. So, the Buddha under the Bodhi tree, just before the enlightenment, the jhanas, and then recollecting his previous lives. This was before he penetrated the Four Noble Truths. If he recognized his previous lives, surely he'd have recognized the big one, the one under Kassapa, the Buddha, as a bhikkhu, as a disciple of Kassapa. And there he would have certainly heard the Four Noble Truths. That is plausible, where Sakyamuni Buddha got the seed, and then the jhanas in this life, and those two together, created enlightenment. It became our Sakyamuni Buddha. Interesting stuff. I like interesting stuff. So that's how Siddhartha Sakyamuni heard the Buddha's teachings. Kassapa, the Buddha's teachings. Dear someone, and actually they didn't even ask you, all they say is, can I sleep in your cave tonight and you sleep in my cottage? Be careful. Because after I did my 6-month personal retreat in silence, not seeing any human being, and really getting into some meditation, 6 months did that. Then afterwards I had to move back into the abbot's kuti, so my kuti was free. And apparently the monks were just vying who would take over my kuti, who would go and stay there after I left. So the one monk who just managed to argue Weedle or just to win the lottery, and he was going to stay in the hut where I did 6 months. And he went in there apparently the first day, he went straight out again. He couldn't stand the energy, which was too much for him, too powerful. It took about 2 or 3 days for the energy to cool off. 6 months of just silent personal meditation. So, could you really stand that energy in the cave? You think you can sleep here. Sometimes you can't at night time. Imagine that cave. Ooh. Ooh. That's strong stuff. Thoughts on walking meditation, please, for beginners. I enjoy going for bush walks. Pace is not slow, nor do I focus directly in front of me all the time. I do have a flow in my mind, although not constant, keeps coming back to the present and to my breathing. Find it really peaceful and enjoyable being out in the fresh air and nature. It is sometimes being nice being out in the fresh air, and the bugs, and the ticks, and the snakes, and the ultraviolet radiation, and the rain, and the harsh winds, and that's okay going out. But please keep, to the right paths, because I don't know, those of you who go up towards Hermes, it happens so often, the neighbor, you get lost. And you always end up with the same neighbor, Don Wood's house. Then you just, he says, oh yeah, another one of Ajahn Brahm's disciples. They think they can find their way to Nibbana. They can't even find their way back to the jhana growth. So he just takes you back. But he gets a bit fed up with it after a while. So anyway, it's okay to go for a walk, but make sure you find your way back. And number two is, when you go for a walk, there's so many different choices to make. Go this way, to go that way, to stop. But when you're in the walking meditation hall, there's hardly any choices to make. You just go forward, turn around, come back again. It's much simpler. So going for a walk in the bush is fine. But if you want to go to university level, you just go walking in one of those halls there. That just takes you a different level. It's far more simple, more peaceful, And also means if you really do get into some really deep, peaceful states of mind, you're just in one door away, you can come in here and sit down and take the peace even deeper. That's the way to go. Can these meditation states be achieved while doing art or music? I've seen a monk in Tibet and other places carving butter, sand, etc. They seem to achieve one point in this journey, these beautiful things. Is finding the right meditation vehicle important to suit your developing karma or personality? You can get so far doing those things, but to get really into it, you've got to close your eyes, not hear sounds, and allow the body to vanish, to get into the real juicy stuff. That's the best way to do it. I think in the Bhayabharava Sutta, the Bodhisattva faced fear by cultivating stillness in whatever meditation posture he was in. One hears that one must sit with one's defilements for hours if needed. This may be seen as letting be or holding on. When and how do you know that this strategy isn't serving you? Doubt arose while being with fear. Shouldn't I be with my breath? What would Ajahn say? Am I closing my heart to the fear? I seem to hear you say, give it a go. So I did until the mind went on another tangent. I'd be grateful for any comments, thank you. So, this is when you go into the forests. Not our forests. Our forests in Australia are pretty tame compared to the tiger-infested, elephant, bear-prowling, snake falling from the trees, sort of jungles. So, very often, Ajahn Chah would say to you, you have to have some good meditation if you go into those jungles. Remember this monk Ajahn Juan telling me about a monk who was fearless, so he thought. And when he went to a certain village, he went there, because when you were a wandering monk on Tudong, you'd always go to the village and see the headman to get a nice place, you know, to stay the night, you know, outside in the forest, and also to let the people know that there was a monk there so they could cook some food for you the following day. So he checked in with the local headman, and the headman said, it's probably better, I know you're a forest monk, for you to stay in the village tonight, because there was a tiger in the district, and the tiger had even captured some of the children and eaten them. So it was a very bad, dangerous tiger. So he said, you better you stay here with us. He said, no, I'm a forest monk. I am not afraid of tigers. So you sure? Yes. Take me into the forest where the tiger trail is. Tonight I will confront that tiger. So the villagers, they took him so they could see in the paths in the jungle where the tiger paths through the jungle. And so he said, right here. And right on the tiger trail, he put up his mosquito net umbrella and they left him there for the night. And so when it got dark, totally dark, he was sitting in his little meditation a mosquito net umbrella, just breathing. And he was doing that mantra in Thailand, Buddha. With the in-breath, Buddha. With the out-breath, Tho. Buddha. He's very quiet. And so was the forest. And then he could hear the jungle animals start to come out. Small ones, medium size. And then he heard this animal come towards him on the path his little tent was on. Boom, boom, boom. And automatically, Buddha became a little bit faster. Buddha, Buddha. And as the noise came louder, because it was approaching closer, Buddha, 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 Buddha. And he couldn't help but open his eyes and get a flashlight out. And he saw this huge tiger coming right for him. And he said he didn't know how he got out from underneath the mosquito net tent. And he didn't start chanting Buddha anymore. And he in-breath, tiger, out-breath, tiger, 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 tiger. And he was running along the path with a tiger chasing him. Tiger, tiger, tiger. And there's a good reason why it's against the rules for monks to run. Because even when I'm sitting, sometimes the robe falls off. Imagine when you're running. Not just this robe. First of all, the outer robe went off, and then the lower robe got loose. And by the time he thought, well, he's getting to safety in the village, tiger, 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 tiger. He had not any piece of brown cloth left on him. And of course, because he was running and shouting, tiger, tiger, everybody woke up and they looked through their windows, through their doors, and they saw this monk practicing bear awareness. Not attached to anything, which he should have been attached to, like his robes. With everything open to inspection. And that was the monk who was not afraid of tigers. So Ajahn Chah would tell me sometimes, oh, don't worry, the tigers have never been known to eat any monk. And that's why I wasn't reassured at all. Because I thought, I didn't argue with your teacher, but I thought when I left him, I said, well, yeah, I mean, how would you know? I mean, the tiger wouldn't confess, and the monk wouldn't be there to say he's been eaten. So some of the monks who survived said, oh yeah, we weren't eaten by tigers. Yeah, that's obvious, otherwise we wouldn't be able to tell anyone. But there was another monk. This was in Laos before the communists took over there. And this monk, he got some great meditators apparently. He would take all the new monks and novices for a walk in the jungle all day. And this was mountainous jungle, really high up and down, and you really got exhausted apparently. And when they came maybe 4 o'clock in the afternoon, maybe five, they come to this clearing in the jungle. And there was these huge, beautiful trees there, you know, rainforest trees, and how old, huge ones. And they had already built, the other monks, a long time ago, these platforms high up in the branches, just the size of these meditation mats you're sitting on. High up, but no railings or guardrails on them. Just a bamboo ladder. And the head monk, the teacher, would tell the disciples, up you go. And they were so exhausted and tired, and they had to sit cross-legged on those platforms. And the master would take the ladder away. See you in the morning, if you're still there. Oh, if you started getting sleepy, you'd fall off to your death. Even if you just got injured, you'd be tiger food. So either way, if you fell off, that was it. And apparently, many monks got very deep experiences. At least the ones who lived to tell the tale. That's using that fear, which is just, yeah, we don't, you know, people say, oh, it's really good, but I don't know. So anyway, because I never saw anyone who failed. So anyway, so using fear, I never think that's good. Why is the Buddha's hair done in a pattern of ringlets? Because, and please don't get upset about this, I think I'm being disrespectful, he must have been African. That's what Africans have, isn't it? A little curly hair. What do you reckon? Now, it's supposed to be that, according to the legend, that when his hair was cut the first time, it went into little ringlets like that, like little snails on his head. However, there's these two occasions at least when people never recognized who the Buddha was. The best one, just, and I like this story because it just shows, just on the outside, the Buddha looked just like an ordinary monk. Because one of his disciples just went over to the west coast of India, and he just was training people over there. And one of the Buddha's disciples, you know, he was doing really well under this senior teacher of the Buddha, and he thought, I want to go and see the Buddha for myself. So he had to travel, walk from the west coast of the Ganges Valley. Another journey, you know, there's many places you could stay out in the forest, or it seemed to be many places people would stay. It would be like at the workshops, which was like a lean-to against the house, and there was some, a carpenter's workshop or something? But anyway, sorry? Potter's workshop. Well, it could have been. Anyway, there's a workshop there, and what's Potter's?
Potter's house.
Potter's house, yes. Some of you know in Perth what Potter's house is, but anyway. So, that's why I think this monk arrived first, and he said, "No, it's okay if I stay here tonight." I don't know, what's the Buddha for? I forget, anyway, it doesn't matter. Anyway, this monk arrived first of all, and so that, you know, okay, you can stay here for the night and make sure you get some food in the morning. Just had a bit of straw so you could. And so a few minutes later, or a short time later on, another monk arrived and asked the same questions. All right, if I stay here tonight? He said, oh, yeah, sure. But there's another monk who came first and said, yeah, no, there's plenty of room here for both of us. So they both were sitting there and they started meditating. And this the first monk started meditating, and so did the second monk, started meditating. And after the first monk had meditated a while, he opened his eyes, the second monk was still sitting very quietly, very peacefully. And so they both decided to sit there all night. And they both were sitting there all night, and afterwards the monk who arrived second said, oh, really good meditation, just who's your teacher? And he said, oh, my teacher is a disciple of the Buddha who went to the west coast of India, and he taught me there. I'm traveling now to meet his master, you know, the Buddha, Sakyamuni Buddha. And he said to the monk who arrived second, who's your teacher? He said, I haven't got one. I am the Buddha. He said, I've spent all night meditating with the Buddha. I've never even paid any respect to you. Oh, please forgive me. And the story is really useful because even a monk in that time could not recognize a Buddha. You know, he was obviously a very good monk, but didn't know any signs, like any hair curled up like that, or any specific features which distinguish a Buddha from another monk. And that's an interesting story there, which often say. So why is the Buddha's hair done in a pattern of ringlets? Again, it was just a tradition, but it wasn't. Obviously, the real Buddha was not. Didn't go to a hairdresser to get the ringlet done. It happened naturally, or it was just an ordinary hair. Is there a good reason to have children, to bring a being into this world of suffering? My girlfriend wants to have children, mainly because that is the life she's always wanted. But I've always felt that having children is selfish. What do you think? Well, sometimes, you know, we have a lot of population over here, but then against that, you know, it may be that you're bringing a good person into this world, give them a human life, where they can maybe sort of learn something about Buddhism. So there's arguments either way. So basically, a good reason to have children is, why are you asking me? Yeah, bring them into a world of suffering, that's one way of looking at it, but it's also give them a chance to understand Dhamma. So it works both ways. A lot of time it either happens. I always prefer if you wanted somebody to love and care for, you know, get a dog. Dogs are so easy to look after. And they just, you know, you can turn them off and they just look at you and smile and wag their tail. Kids don't do that. And the dog said, don't cost that much money. You don't have to go take them to school and get them a nice education when they're stupid. Just go and get them a special education or a tutor to do things. And you get a lot of emotional satisfaction out of a dog. They just lick you and they just wag their tail. You take them for walks and they're just very nice and helpful. And they can do all sorts of nice things for you. They don't cost so much. They don't cause you so much trouble and heartache. Dogs never speak back to you. So for me, anyway, you know, if I didn't live in the mug life, I'd get a dog. Even better than a dog. Even better than a dog is a teddy bear. Teddy bears are even cheaper to look after. They give you lots of emotional comfort. They're there for you when you need them. When you don't need them, put them in the cupboard. You can't do that with a dog. So I think the best one would be a teddy bear. Today, for the first time, I experienced handing over the breath completely to the mind. Oh, excellent. This felt good, and I would have continued to let go, but I had to stop. You didn't have to stop, because I started feeling nauseous. Really? Probably because I have just gulped down a glass of oranges before the sitting. Okay. Is this hand-off stage the same as your stage of full sustained awareness of the orange juice? No, with the breath, sorry. Could be. But if it's really, really nice and beautiful, then I feel nauseous. Okay, but next time, don't gulp down a glass of orange juice. It may be a bit acidic. I was going to say ascetic, but probably the same thing. Just the next time, you're learning lessons. The next time, just let the breath complete to the mind, and it felt good. Yeah, I would have said that's a beautiful breath, a rightful breath. Ajahn Brahm, does an enlightened, awakened person have any preference, e.g. in taste, frozen yogurt bar like, rice porridge not like? Where does this frozen yogurt thing come from? But isn't like a dislike a form of attachment, suffering? Like and dislike, why is it liking and dislike? Sometimes that we have this reflection of when monks eat, to make sure we eat not for fun, not for fattening, not for beautification, only for the maintenance and nourishment of this body, for ending old feelings of hunger, and not getting new feelings of overeating, so I can live blamelessly and at ease. It's the purpose of eating. And so there's sometimes people just have an aversion to frozen yogurt bar-like porridge. So whatever it is, if they have an allergy towards it, and if you have an allergy towards it, then obviously you should say no to it. So, you know, sometimes that, you know, because my father was asthmatic, so I didn't have asthma, but I did take on some of his allergies. And, you know, so I'd always wondered why I never liked apples. I liked the taste, but they always made me queasy. Until later on, I thought, this is an allergy. I had a full-blown allergy once to walnuts. Remember, I was in Durham at the time, and I didn't know what was going on. But I came out in hives all over my body, and I couldn't breathe. And that was really dangerous. You know, it was a hyper-allergic reaction. But you know, I was meditating at the time, so I just found a nice bench by the river in Durham, and I just meditated until I was relaxed enough. And that's how I overcame that. And I saw the doctor afterwards, and he said, well, you know, probably with your father's history, with some allergy there, and you may never get it again. Well, I did get it once, but much lighter, and that was the end of that one. But there was also, when I was a monk, you had to eat all sorts of stuff. And sometimes you got sick, but a lot of time you're okay. And then as you got older, you got tummy. It was really sort of the way it was treated in Thailand. Sometimes I wonder why I survived all the stuff you ate there. And I won't gross you out with all the terrible food I ate, because that's going to be the first... Well, one of the terrible foods I ate in Thailand, that's in the introduction to that cookbook, The Frog on Rice. But anyway, you can buy that cookbook for raising funds for NBM, that's over in Melbourne, at another time. But this particular time, I think it was in Malaysia, and I was just eating whatever people gave me, and giving a talk in Champaka Buddhist Lodge to about 2,000 people, and then I almost got through it, but then at question time I said, no, I have to finish now. So I don't have some more questions. I just put down the microphone and started walking off the stage, but I never made it. Projectile vomiting in front of 2,000 people. A fitting ending to my talk. But that was so wonderful because people said, oh my goodness, you know, monks do get sick. So from that time on, they just started, asking me exactly what I needed to eat to make me feel sort of a good tummy, what you could digest. So that's why even monks look after them, and nuns, because monks and nuns do have allergies. And it's not that they just got cast iron stomachs, they can put anything in. you wouldn't put things in like that. So just, you look after. And the Satipatthana Samyutta, mindfulness. They give the simile of a cook. And the two types of cook. And the first cook, they just give their employer whatever they think. And then they don't pay any notice to what their employer eats. And soon they get sacked. And the other cook is mindful. They put this food out, that food, and they found out what their employer eats the most of and what they leave. And that way, even without asking, they find out what suits their employer. In the same way, they say, when you are meditating, you're mindful of what works for you. Whether it's mindfulness of the breath or mindfulness of the body, find out what works. So the cook tries it out and gets the feedback, see what works. And that cook becomes very popular with her employer, as Bianca does. She finds out, what people eat, what they don't eat, and looks after you. In the same way you find out what works for you and what doesn't work for you in your meditation practice. Dear priceless Ajahn Brahm, would you please advise how to take a break from my busy life that seems like full of to-do lists so I can have a work-life balance like yours? Always in high spirits and happy. Is my work-life balanced? Mm-hmm. Some of the stuff which I get up to, get to do. Anyway, so, but you can still be happy. So, how do you take time off? The story of the person who rang up the temple, and the monk answered, and the caller said, oh great, I've got through to you. Can you come to my house to do a ceremony? Just moved into a new house, I need a blessing ceremony. Can you come? And the monk said, sorry, I'm busy today. He said, well, what are you busy with? Saying not busy with duties. He said, oh no, today I'm doing nothing all day. So that's what monks are supposed to do. Lead by example. Just relax. Let go. So I'm doing nothing today. So the person understood. Oh, well done. This is what a monk should be doing. Congratulations. This inspires me. That, you're just living what you teach. Just being peaceful. Spending a day doing nothing. Wonderful. Wouldn't you like to do that? So he said, oh, okay, sadhu. And the next day, the gentleman rang again, got through to the same monk. Oh, good, I'm back to you. Look, I really need someone, especially you, to come to my house today and do this blessing for me. Can you come? He said, no, I'm busy. I said, well, monk, what are you doing today? He said, same as yesterday, I'm doing nothing. Well, that was your excuse yesterday. Oh, yes, said the monk, but I'm not finished yet. So put that on your to-do list, first of all. Nothing. And don't go to the second thing on your to-do list until you've finished. You've finished your nothing time. Isn't that wonderful? But the trouble is, if you try that at home, And you're sitting there, and your husband said, "Darling, what are you doing?" I said, "Nothing." "Oh, great, come and help me." Because they think nothing means you're available. So I never advise people to do that anymore. If they ask you, "What are you doing?" you say, "I'm watching the trees grow." That's where that thing came from. "Okay, fair enough, off you go." But if you say you're not doing anything, people in the world think you are just free to help them. That's the problem. So when people say, "Oh, monks are doing nothing all day." If I was doing nothing all day, "Oh, can you come and give a retreat? Can you come and answer my questions?" There was a space in the interview list this afternoon. "Oh, so you know you're free, I can come and ask a question." That's what, I'm telling you all my tricks, aren't I? Okay, well, I'm being honest. You might have seen in the interview list today and yesterday that two of the people this afternoon had interviews was Sam Atta and Vipassana. I wrote those in to give myself a bit of space. If I just left it free, then some of the more people put their name in. "Oh, it's free, I would go and have an interview." Yesterday there was, I think, Akinchana, which means no name, and Anama, Anna, and the other thing was Sunya, so no one. No, I'm letting you know my tricks now. If you see those names on there, you probably scrub them out and know the trick and put your name on there instead. Anyway, could you please explain a bit more about the term will? You talked about the will disappears in a jhana in this morning's talk. Thank you. Ooh, the will. That is a scary subject. But this is what happens. I've already told briefly the story about the tadpole and the frog. I didn't actually tell it, that much. But anyway, the full story. Tadpole was born in a retreat center in a pond as a very smart little tadpole. She went to school and she graduated just with the top of the school and with other ducks, that's it. She graduated, because ducks is what happens in a pool, so it's appropriate that she graduated with the ducks. I try to make a joke out of that, but sometimes the jokes work, sometimes they don't. They need a bit of improvement. But anyway, ducks means the leader of the school, the head. So they went to university in the pond still, where she majored in chemistry, especially hydrology, water. And so this little tadpole, she knew everything about water, and because it was in a retreat center, every now and again they got these monks who would actually just sit by the side of the lake and they would discuss the Abhidharma. So not only did she knew the nature of water in chemistry and science, but also knew the nature of water as one of the four elements. So this tadpole knew everything about water intellectually. But do you think that tadpole knew what water really was? Because little tadpole had lived all her life in the water. Born in the water, grew up in the water, studied in the water, played in the water, knew nothing else except water. No more than a fish could know what water is. But the difference between a fish and a little tadpole is that the tadpole grows legs and arms. And one day, a little tadpole, not knowing what she's doing, not expecting anything, not willing or controlling, but just following the instructions, she appears out of the lake. Just like you little tadpoles have already grown enough legs and arms through the powers of meditation, that one day you'll jump out of these five senses and be standing in a place, or rather sitting in the jhanas, places you've never known before. Weird, strange, but fun. So little tadpole, she's now a frog. She's out on the side of the lake on dry soil. Weird. Nothing like it has ever happened before to her. Strange, because something there is missing. Something which always was there ever since she could knew
could know anything has now disappeared. Water. It's not supposed to disappear. But now it's gone. And now little frog finally could know what water was. The water was anicca. It doesn't mean impermanent, comes and goes. It means vanishes. It's not there anymore. It's gone. It's not constant. Things which are always there, we take for granted. We can't even experience them. But once they've gone, now we know what they are. So little tadpole, who can only know the nature of water once it's disappeared. You little tadpoles, becoming frogs, once your will disappears, then you can know what it is. From now, you may not always use the will. You may just put it aside for a while, but it's always there for you. Anytime you want, you can make a choice. But there's no choice left anymore. The buttons are all gone. Nothing to press. In jhanas, especially the second jhana, the will is totally absent. That's why it's called the joy, the piti sukha, born of stillness. You can't do anything. It's gone. Will vanished. Where did will go? It's not there. Come out afterwards, it's weird. The will vanished totally. That's why it's so still. That's why you can meditate for hours. So, now you know what the will is. And it's freaky, it's spooky. But there is your experience. Exactly how the Buddha taught. So now you know what will is. It doesn't come from you. That's why Sakyamuni Buddha couldn't become enlightened by himself. The will, he couldn't choose to. Had to come from the previous Buddha. Brainwashing, conditioning, paratagosa, the words of another, in the Chula Vedala Sutta. One of the causes for becoming a Supreme Winner, let alone fully enlightened. Ooh. So you've got no choice. Unfortunately, it's already too late for most of you. You're going to become enlightened. Head for the door now, but it's not going to work. It's too late, guys, girls. You're going, going, gone. That's also why Brahma Sahampati had to come and request Sakyamuni Buddha to teach. Couldn't do it himself. Needed a little prompt. Because his will had totally gone. Subdued. Someone said, please teach out of compassion. Okay. That's what was needed. So, that is the nature of the will. And do you think that you're in control of your will? Advertising. $3 for every dollar spent, they say, in advertising industry. Have you ever seen those adverts? They are just so juvenile. Who would ever believe in those? So my stupid believing in an advertisement when I was a student, I got sucked into this. It's supposed to be intelligent. This is what I did. St. Bruno tobacco, irresistible to the opposite sex. That was so the advertisement on the TV. This ordinary looking guy, well, just like me, about the same age. He was walking down the street, people left him alone. But then he got one of these pipes. You know, pipes were supposed to be, you know, what you use as intellectual, you know. What was it? Albert Einstein, he had a pipe. And there was, you know, that's how you could contemplate and just break through all these very difficult theories like the special theory of relativity and stuff. And so all these scientists say, you know, many of them had these pipes. It was just, you know, just, it was part of the uniform for Nobel laureates. So anyway, I got one of these pipes, St. Bruno tobacco. And in the advertisement, once you lit the pipe, the tobacco was so aromatic, because this ordinary-looking guy going through an ordinary-looking street in somewhere in England, and is amazingly gorgeous blonde, working in a bank or something. As soon as she smelt the aroma, she was enchanted, captivated. She jumped over the counter and followed him, waiting for the first command. She was totally enchanted. And then past the greengrocers, and a beautiful redhead came out, and then went past another shop, and a brunette came out, and just amazingly, like supermodels, like you don't ever see in the real world, but they were just amazing. And more importantly, in a male fantasy, they were willing to do anything you asked, because St. Bruno tobacco is irresistible to the opposite gender. As well as being sexist and just demeaning and just all sorts of stuff. And I was a scientist, you know, but I bought some. And I lit up a fire in the streets of Cambridge. I walked past all these shops and no one came out. And I looked behind me, the only thing following me was a dog. It was so disappointing. And I just got sucked in. Or did I get sucked in, or did I get brainwashed? Because that's what the advertisements do. And the trick with advertising is you don't know you're being brainwashed. You think, it's so stupid, who would ever believe in that? So your guard is down, you don't defend yourself. And that gets in, convinces you that that is what you should do. What else? You've been brainwashed. So this is one of the reasons why I counter brainwash you. I admit I'm conditioning, I'm brainwashing you. All these talks, especially when you talk in a low tone, like I do when I do guided meditations. That is how you hypnotize people. There was the story of the monk started a new temple and had very difficulty getting any donations. You've got to pay money, you know, for all of the lights and the rates, and it's very expensive sometimes, all this council stuff you have to do. So this monk was just really finding it hard. So he went to another monk, his teacher, and said, oh, it's very easy to pay for things. All you need to do is when you give a talk in the temple, just make sure you turn the heaters on. So it's very hot. And close all the windows so it's stuffy. And when you give a talk, give a boring talk. In a monotone. In a low voice. Slow. Monotone. And it's hot. And it's stuffy. And soon you'll see people start to have sloth and torpor. They're about to go to sleep. And at that time, he said, that's who almost got them. And they said, just get out one of these old fob watches. You know these old watches they used to hypnotize people? Get out and say, look at the watch. Back and forward. Until they're all hypnotized. And once they're under your control, you tell them, as you leave, in the donation box, no coins, no fives, tens, twenties or fifties, only hundreds. I said, I can't do that. That's fraud. It's not fraud. It's encouraging people to do good karma. So, you know, that's what we're supposed to do as monks, encourage you to make good karma for your next lives. So he tried it anyway. And so, no, he didn't say just hundreds, fifties or hundreds. So, he gave a boring sermon, closed all the windows, make it really hot. When people are about to fall asleep, hypnotize, watching bows and forwards. Only fifties or hundreds as you walk out. And then that's what they did. The donation box was stuffed with $50, $100 notes. He made a fortune. Even, but of course, it didn't last long. You had to sort of pay this bill and that bill. And so when he needed some money again, he tried it one more time. So he closed all the windows, made it really warm, gave a boring sermon, he was used to that now, and about to fall asleep, he got out his watch and about to get hypnotized, and he dropped the watch, and it broke. And he said, oh, shit. And it took them a couple of weeks to clean up the hall. Okay. That's the trouble with hypnosis. It comes back to bite you. Anyway, that's only a joke. Never really happened. But I remember telling that one a Katina day. And I was about to get to the punchline. That was when Ajahn Yanadamo was here. About to get to the punchline, and he disconnected the microphone. Oh, come on, you're Aussie. You know, you should have a sense of humour. Anyway, what is the feedback that one is caring for at the moment and not trying to change it into something else? No, the feedback is when you find out if it's working or not. So, because sometimes we think we're letting go, we think we're caring for the moment, we ain't. And if we're not, you know, we get less peaceful. This is some of the things when people say, how do I let go? I know I'm supposed to let go, but what is letting go? I'm letting go, I think I'm letting go, but it's not working. If it's not working, it means you're not letting go. So, try some trial and error. Try this, try that. And if you get very peaceful, well done, that was letting go. If you get tense, then you were doing something. This is how you learn from the feedback what letting go is. For caring, open the door of your heart to this moment. Does this moment get easier to watch or more tense? If it's more tense, you are not doing caring. You're doing something else. So that's what the mindfulness does. It gives you that feedback so you know exactly what works, what doesn't work. And then you find, that's what letting go is. Dear Ajahn, we've talked about different monsters that come during meditation, such as worries or pains that may have an emotional background. You said to welcome. I did. Only one demon at a time. Can you please tell more tips about monster management during meditation? Yes, monster management during meditation. Get the most important demon, first of all. And also, I use that the simile of the snake, one demon at a time. And I got that from when I was in Thailand. Not exaggeration, there were so many snakes around, and we didn't have any proper shoes. You know, the sandals, they'd wore out very quickly, and we couldn't have any replacement. We tied them with string and all sorts of stuff. But, you know, that after a while, we didn't have any to walk back in the evening. After the talks on meditation, there were snakes there. Or ants, or centipedes, all sorts of creepy crawlers, which regarded your toes as their dinner. And so that whenever I walked back in the evening without any sandals on, and even the flashlight sometimes had no batteries, so I used sometimes a starlight, which wasn't much. But then, whenever I saw a shadow across the path, it could have been a stick, it could have been a snake, but I would always be alert for it. It was my snake, so I was looking out for it. So I'd either go a different way or jump over it, anything, just in case. I was always very mindful, alert, just on guard for any shadows across the path. So that became my simile of the snake. I never got bitten, neither did anyone else, simply because we were watching out for them. And that's the same with your monsters, whatever that monster is. It may be still attachment to your family. It may be sort of, you know, fear of what people think of you, or some sort of problem which keeps coming up in your meditation, or maybe like drooling or crying or something. You don't want people to see that. So you're trying to avoid it one monster at a time. You start your meditation, I'm going to be very on the alert for this monster happening. This snake biting me off. Like a sloth and torpor by suffocating me. And then, of course, you're on the lookout for it. You see it early. When you see it early, you always find a way of dealing with it. And the story which comes to mind is, I think I already mentioned, or just mentioned somewhere, but this fellow Ananda, who was a Vietnam War veteran, got shot in the back of the head as a US Marine. And because of that, he had epilepsy.
And it's because of the wound. He had to take out quite a bit of the back of his head. But that epilepsy, which he had when he was developed over in England, in Chitos Monastery, he was mindful of it. And he got more and more mindful. He could see it earlier and earlier and earlier. Until he got to a stage in the first beginnings of the epilepsy. So the epileptic fit, So that when it was about, he knew if he just carried on doing this, he would have the fit. So he captured it earlier and found different ways of dealing with it. And until he found a way he could avoid the epilepsy. Usually he said, was stopping what he was doing immediately, going to his room, turning on the lights, laying down and meditating. He never had an epileptic fit after that. So he managed to catch it earlier and earlier and earlier. It was like a snake for him. It was like a monster. And getting to know that monster, catching it earlier and earlier and earlier and earlier, he could always take another path. Any advice on dealing with girlfriend who has jealousy issues? Wow, you're so lucky. She must like you if she's jealous of you or jealous of other people. Anyway, she gets upset when I get a little chatty with waitresses. This is an interesting question. Shall we go further? This is the sort of question people like. She feels insecure when I get phone calls from female friends. These days, I try not to make or take calls from female friends when she's around. And I also stop responding to some female friends upon her request. I do love my girlfriend. We are both Buddhist practitioners and I hope we can grow together. Okay, she feels insecure when you get phone calls from female friends. So what to do with a girl like that? Now, one of the things, I always tell girls, if you want a stable relationship, never ever go out and marry a rich, handsome guy. Marry a poor, ugly one. Then he never gets any comments from friends or from our waitresses. So if you marry and have a friendship with a poor, ugly guy, then you never need to feel jealous. And guys, never marry a beautiful woman. Because the same with you. You never know. You maybe go on a retreat. You're not quite sure what she's up to when you're on a retreat. But if you marry an ugly one, then you're safe. You can go on a retreat. You can go... you can go golfing. It doesn't matter because you know she's safe. No one wants her. That's my secret for a happy life. It shows you why I'm a monk, not a marriage counselor. So there's jealousy. The trouble is, whatever you fear might happen because you're jealous and controlling, if you fear it's going to happen, actually make it happen, or you give it more opportunity to happen. You're increasing the probability. Because, you know, she's jealous when you're chatting with waitresses and waitresses. Well, this lady really likes this guy. There must be something to him. And so it actually increases the chances. Oh, the waitress might think, oh, that's something really important. So if you're not jealous and your boyfriend chatted, the waitress says, you know, you say, oh, if you want him, you can have him. I've been with him a long time. Nah, if you don't want him, I'm not going to have him. So if you're afraid, then sometimes that your poor partner, she doesn't trust me. Where's the relationship if you don't trust one another? So one antidote to that is, can you please tell your boyfriend, and boyfriend tells you, or the other way around, that, look, you know, we trust one another. And please, you can tell me anything. Don't lie to me. As long as you tell me the truth, I will never punish you or feel bad about you. We do make mistakes sometimes, but I want you to own up. So, you know, if you're chatting to that waitress, and that, you know, that waitress, you like that waitress, then tell me. Because a lot of guys, girls, we are committed to a stable relationship. But sometimes that, you know, we can, that's why affairs can happen. Sometimes there's an attraction there. Of course, I haven't seen this, but basic instinct, you know, just to flirt. But if that's really upsetting you, just, you know, say, look, that really upsets me. And you probably say, oh, sorry, I didn't realize that. There's nothing really going on. And if there is, sort of, I will tell you first of all, because I want the relationship to last. I need your help. So when you have a problem like that, please work it out together. Just join forces. Don't hide it from your partner, but tell your partner. And then a lot of times, together, you can stop a problem. So that's actually where, in a relationship, always have amnesty with your partner as long as they tell the truth. That solves a lot of problems. Outside of meditation, should we desire for or let go of enlightenment? Outside of meditation, you should go and wash your dishes. Do they go like, outside of meditation, inside of meditation, you should desire for the causes of enlightenment. What those causes are? Eightfold Path. Dear expensive Ajahn, most of my thought is arising. Is most of my thought arising from my ego? Yeah. If stillness is a necessary and sufficient for enlightenment, Alaraka Lama Uddhaka Ramaputta would have been enlightened once before Siddhartha. Obviously there is more. Of course it is necessary but not sufficient. So any donation to Albany Project, not tax deductible as a donation. Is this what you said? Is this correct? How can it make it tax deductible? It's not a donation. Then you're getting something out of it. Giving, expecting nothing back in return. You're giving just because it needs to be given. Isn't that a wonderful thing? So that's the best donations are ones which no one knows about, not even the tax office. Doesn't mean it's like under the table or it's money laundering or anything. It just means it's a beautiful thing to do. It's just sometimes the only way we can get tax deductibility, and it is causing me huge headaches and everyone else headaches, and Venerable Metaji headaches with the ATO, is to be a school building fund. And before I was noticed that, you know, teaching meditation was qualified because the boundaries interpretation of a school were very wide. But now tax office is getting a bit more demanding. We should teach in the Metta Sutta. Not be proud and demanding in nature. Be content and easily satisfied with the little you get. That's what we should do. But they're not. So anyway, because we are a charity. No, we're a charity. And the reason that you're supposed to be able to give donations to a charity, because you know, you've already paid taxes before, and it's a charity, it's doing good for the community. But to prove that, because religions have got a bad name over in Australia ever since the sex abuse scandals. So anyway, the Albany Project is not tax deductible yet. We're working on it, but I'm not quite sure how that will go. But in the meantime, just, if you've got any spare cash, can you turn up the heaters, please? You will give to... No, you don't want to do that, because when you give, like, freely, and you see what happens. Look at this place. All the people who gave donations to this place, and now you can enjoy it. And it gives you so much, wow, we've really done something. Made it good. To the nuns' monastery, that was brilliant. And it just... All the donations come to the Muslim. That's really inspiring, continues to inspire me, that place. I'm going over time again, but this is great stuff. What do we do to get a nuns' monastery? Put an article in the our newsletter and then open up a bank account. Yeah. We've got about $20,000, $30,000. Can't buy a nuns' monastery for that. And so maybe you can get a parking lot, or maybe just, I don't even know, only rent it. So anyway, it's really going nowhere. Until this one occasion, I always love this story. You may have heard it before, but this is great.
this guy came to Bodhinyana Monastery. Not a very expensive car. And he was wearing Australian national dress. As you all know, his thongs, short and a singlet. He came out of his car and, you know, he just looked like just ordinary guy. And then he said, I'm a Buddhist, he said. And I think just a few days ago, my wife gave birth to my first child, who's a girl. Oh, congratulations. And he said, I want to do some charity, some merit, you know, for my daughter, for the birth, a successful birth. And he said that, I hear you're building a monastery for nuns, for bhikkhunis. I said, yeah, well, we're not building it yet. He said, I know, just collecting donations. And I want to give you a donation for the bhikkhuni monastery. I don't know if my little daughter, who's only a couple of days old, if she would ever want to become a Buddhist nun, but I want her to have the opportunity in case she does. So I want to give a donation to the nuns monastery, maybe only about 20,000-30,000 at the time. And he gave me a check, $250,000, $250,000. And I don't usually get excited, but I was shaking. That was a big check, $250,000, much like that, and I never knew the guy. He didn't ask for a tax receipt. In fact, I never saw him again. And that was a weird part. He never checked up and see how we're going. I don't know who he is. And to this day, sometimes, you know, was that a real person? Or was it a heavenly being? I don't know. But it was really inspiring that that could actually happen. And of course, that meant it was happening. Oh, those sorts of things are really amazing. So I don't know who he is. Okay. Dear Ajahn, you are loved by all of us. Well, that's a problem. You know, once, Basel story, people asked, what's the scariest thing which ever happened to you? And that was when, I remember very clearly, one of the most scariest, I don't think anything beats this for me. But anyway, that just still at university, I think the last year, one of my friends got married. And so, had the marriage and reception in the college. And then afterwards, you know, young men standing around, you know, all dressed in suits, you know, with our friends, you know, of the opposite sex. And we're just chatting like stupid young men do. And then one of us said, "No, I wonder who the next one is going to be." Because they were all eligible bachelors, you know, good looking, good education, good prospects in life. And so, I think one of us, I don't know who it was, we pointed out to this, one of our men, friends, Jeff, said he'd probably be next. And then all the guys said, nah, no one will marry him. And so the next one pointed, it was me. And they pointed out, you know, my lay name was Peter. Oh, Peter, he'll be next. And then the guy said, nah, no one will marry him. And this is a true story. This is etched into my brain, as many traumatic events are. There's a girl standing next to me, and she whispered in my ear, I would. I was terrified. I was scared. And I made sure I was a long distance from her for the rest of the day and night, the rest of the year. But these days I felt poor girl. But anyway, yeah, you're loved by us all. Hopefully just... But the greatest act of love is to let people be. Does enlightenment refer to light as opposed to dark as well as opposed to heavy? Thank you. May you be fully enlightened. That's why I like awakened is much better. Enlightened, yeah, light... if light means not heavy, I don't think I will qualify. Dark as opposed to heavy, yeah. No, it just means awaken, that's the best one. Be at peace with yourself. So, no more striving. Right, sitting under the Bodhi tree. Not wanting anything in the whole world. Finished, peaceful. Just like this talk is now finished. And you can have some peace. Not under the Bodhi tree, but under your duvet or blankets.
Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. And so it wasn't because so many questions, it's because I got too many stories. It's my fault, I admit it. Very good. Sorry? Getting later and later and later. Yeah, I know. Oh, we just won't finish, we'll just talk all night. Okay, I'll let you go.